So we just took a cruise. We just went cruising.
Yes, we took a...
It must be Friday.
It's Monday, Carrington.
Oh, goodness. It's still March.
We took a virtual cruise.
What's a virtual cruise?
Every year I have been on the Jonathan Colton cruise, the Joko cruise, which is a fun week of nerdy fun on the high seas.
A fun week of nerdy fun?
On the high seas, yes.
And high seas.
Yes.
Because he's got quite a range.
Yes. Yeah. He's a soprano. But this year it is not happening because there's some sort of virus going around making people ill.
Oh, I hadn't heard about that.
Yeah, I heard something about in the news. So they didn't hold the cruise this year, but they had a virtual cruise, which they did some of their shows, some of their tomfoolery, some of their geeky things done online and on YouTube and on Zoom and things. And we participated.
We? You and me?
Yes.
That we?
Us.
the we that is us? Well, that's fantastic. Why did we participate? What would we have to contribute?
Well, we just gave a talk, and it was called We Played Every Infocom Text Adventure.
You know what's coincidence? We did play every Infocom Text Adventure.
We did. Yes, we did. So I thought it would be excellent, appropriate for us to give a talk with that title. And we just gave it a few minutes ago, and we talked for 50 minutes to a crowd of 50 people.
50 minutes on the dot, baby.
Yeah, that's right. And we had a good time sharing the joy of Infocom with a small group of nerds.
Talking about what we learned, what we loved, how we laughed. Oh, there was growth. I grew as a person. Now, it was kind of similar to our episode we had called Take All, where we recapped playing all the text adventures. I found it interesting to come back to this topic a while later. I've been wondering how much my opinions will change over time. Like the games that I thought were great then, do I still think they're great 5 years from now? Will my opinions change? I do find that I'm thinking more about games that I don't think at the time I necessarily thought were going to be my favorites. And now I keep thinking about replaying Bureaucracy and stuff like that, which I wouldn't have predicted would be the games I want to come back to. That's interesting.
Yeah, I found that, and there were certain games that I think at the time I had very strong opinions about, and they were almost forgettable. I really had to rack my brain going like, which one was that? So yeah, when I was making my list of favorite games and least favorite games, I'm just like, I really wonder how same or different it was than the list I made just 3 months ago with you.
Me too. But it's still the case that you don't like Sherlock.
True.
It's still the case that I don't like Border Zone, and neither of us really like Zork 1. So some things are eternal.
That's true, indeed.
Yep.
So we gave this talk, and frankly, if you are a regular listener to this podcast, you're not going to learn anything. A lot of it's background about what is Infocom and that sort of thing. But we didn't, you know, maybe our audience didn't know those things. So we thought it'd be fun to throw out a bonus episode of extra free content, for our favorite listener, you.
One thing people should be warned about is, unlike the normal format, we didn't put in the normal spoiler fence, but we did thoroughly spoil a puzzle. So if you have not played Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and you would like to, well, then you can consider this another spoiler fence for that game, because we talk in detail about the specific solution to a famous puzzle in that game. So if you don't want to know that solution, and you've been waiting 35 years and you don't want it spoiled, another spoiler fence to you.
That's right. What are you waiting for? It's been 35 years.
Play the game, man. Play the game.
There's a pandemic happening. Maybe this is the week you play Hitchhikers.
Excellent. Finally, we motivated someone. I dig it. So yeah, so I think we're going to insert the talk now, right? So people can enjoy our high seas adventure.
Excellent.
Enjoy is doing a lot of heavy lifting in that sentence, but you know.
You are likely to be eaten. You are likely.
by a group. If this predicament seemed particularly cruel, consider who's fault it could be. Now the torture of a match in your inventory. You are likely to be eaten by a group. If this predicament seemed particularly cruel, consider who's fault it could be. Now the torture of a match in your inventory.
This is We Played Every Infocom Text Adventure, and we're going to tell you all about it. Good, the bad, the textily ugly. So we're going to start with who we are. Kay, why don't you tell them who we are?
Hi, I'm Kay Savitz. I have played every Infocom Text Adventure. I am a microcomputer historian specializing in Atari computers, and I get to play Infocom games with Carrington.
I am the Carrington of which he speaks. I'm a podcaster up here in Toronto, Canada. This whole shebeal was Kay's idea. Got hold of me. We've both been podcasting for years. But 4 or 5 years ago, he said, hey, why don't we play every single Infocom game and then talk about them? And so we did for something year project.
Carrington foolishly agreed with me.
I foolishly agree with most of what my friends say. And so we started a podcast called Eaten by a Gru, which we continue to do, where we play and discuss text adventures, so far primarily Infocom games. And that's what we're going to talk to you guys about today. So I think we're going to talk first about what a text adventure is, in case there's people here that are younger than the hills. It is essentially a game, just like it says, that is an adventure using only or primarily text. So the computer types some stuff to you, describes a scene, says you're in a room, there is an anvil with a sword sticking out of it, and a slathering monster is romping at you, and then you type what you want your avatar to do. So no pointing, no clicking, just typing. You might type, take the sword and attack the monster, and then the computer describes the results of what you said. The computer might say, you yank on the sword, but not being the true king of England, it does nothing for you, and you are eaten, you are dead, do you want to try again? Then that's often how these games go. And that's basically the entirety of the game, and everything is played in your mind.
Right, and the company that kind of many companies did these back in the late 70s and in early 80s, and for instance there was Colossal Cave Adventure was kind of the big first one that people knew, and a guy called Scott Adams did a bunch of games, and a lot of those early games, the parser, the thing that understands what you type, understood two words. You could type go north or take sword or kill monster, and that was all it could understand. And then so eventually this company came around, and it was called Infocom, and one of their neat things was that their parsers could understand. Literally, you could type take the sword out of the stone and then kill the monster with it, and it would understand, or just more complex things than just simple two-word sentences.
Yeah, and I don't think it'd be prudent to find a point on it to say that Infocom was the household name of text adventures, especially in the 80s. They kicked off with Zork, which became very famous. A lot of people still know it, talk about it, that sort of thing. And it was a high fantasy game originally out of Mayframe, and then got divided up into multiple pieces called Zork 1, Zork 2, and Zork 3. Essentially, Zork 1 and 2 and about half of 3 were the original Mayframe game repackaged in multiple adventures, but they also made a ton of other games, some of which are showing on screen right now, in a lot of different genres. And so that was fun. Like, most people think of text adventures as just being high fantasy. It's just swords and sorcery and grues and wizards and such. But they also did hard science fiction and action adventure games and mystery games and comedy and satire and like a whole bunch of stuff, which is fun. Like, I've really enjoyed going through the catalog because we've been able to play so many of them. I think there's
35 canonical games, yeah. And they really tried to, after they did the first couple of Zork games, they really started to try to push the boundaries and show people that this was a new form of literature. That was kind of what they were, the marketing angle they were going for a while. This wasn't just killing dragons. This was you know, you could be the detective inside a mystery book and figure out who done it. And they did several of those games. And, you know, like at the time, like the New York Times would like write big articles about this. Like, is this a new form of literature? And so on. So it was a new kind of game, and it was pretty incredible for the time. And the graphics are great because they're all in your mind.
Yeah, the most powerful graphic processor available, your mind. They would often advertise it as such. But the games looked like this. Here's an example of what a text adventure, particularly an Infocom game, looks like. This is the fairly famous opening to Zork, where you start west of a White House, where there's a mailbox. And Kay has begun the game. You're doing excellent. I see you've made 3 moves, and your score is currently 0.
So
you haven't died yet. So
right, no, I haven't died yet. I will very soon. And it says yes. West of house. You're standing west of an open field of White House. You know, there's a mailbox here. You type open mailbox. Opening the mailbox reveals a leaflet. Take leaflet. You know, taken. Inventory. And the inventory is kind of like, what am I holding? You know, you're carrying a leaflet. Yay, I managed to pick up a leaflet.
Now, fun thing about this is there's lots of little Easter eggs and fun things inside Infocom games, and there became a lot of tropes that would play out in various games and then became things in future text adventures as well. And one of the things is right here, where you take this leaflet, and if you were to read it, it tells you about the game. Like, basically, it's like a little thing. Hey, this is Zork, and it was made by so-and-so. So often, inside the game itself will be a thing that you can find that will tell you the serial number and the writer of the game you're currently playing. So that's kind of fun. And so you've got inventory and inventory management and such. So all the things that plague later adventure games also plague Infocom games. But this is it. Like, this is what you stare at. White on black, or green on black, or white on red, or white on white if you want to really up the challenge mode. But like, this is it. Like, everything is done in your mind. There's no mapping. You just take notes, keep it in your head, try to solve puzzles, make your own map, which we'll talk about later, and the difficulty of that. But as Kay said, like, the thing that really set, I think, Infocom apart from everybody else, and one of the big deals was the parser. It was natural language, full text. What we were just looking at here was doing what most people actually do in reality, which is type things like take leaflet, go north. The reality is, typically you fall back on the two-word typing, but you can do complex sentences, and often that will be required to solve a puzzle. Like, they do take advantage of that complex natural language parser, and that's the thing that made Infocom, I think, a household name. Like, made like Zork games kind of like the Kleenex of text adventures, which everybody wants to be the Kleenex of something, I think.
Sure, absolutely.
Don't you, Kay? Don't you?
Yeah, I also want to mention that in the screenshot I took before, I took that on an Apple II, but these games, one of the neat things that this company did was basically you were running a virtual machine that ran their system. So the same game could literally run, I mean, Zork ran, the first version of Zork ran on a PDP-11, and then they came out with a TRS-80 version, and then it also would later came out for the Apple II and the Atari 800, and eventually, you know, the Macintosh and the Amiga, and the same game could run on many, many different machines, which helped their sales by quite a bit, because at the time there were many different disparate machines that were not compatible with each other.
It's also the reason why it's fairly easy to play these games nowadays, because the game code itself is essentially just text in a language called ZIL, Z-I-L, and it's interpreted by the thing that is unique for each platform. So there's a little program that runs on the Apple II, and it interprets that bunch of pseudocode. But if you take one of those, what are called a .z file, and say .z5, .z3, that file of this pseudocode is very easy to run on a modern computer, because there's lots of interpreters that have been written for modern things. Like, Kay and I frequently played this on modern computers, because it makes it super accessible. And being just text, you can play it on everything imaginable. Probably your fridge can play it. Like, it's crazy how accessible these games are. Not easy, but easy to get a hold of. So another thing that set them apart, that made them exciting, you had that great, great browser, but also Infocom became famous for their feelies and their browsies. Odd name. So the feelies were the physical things that would come inside a game. So since these were games that didn't have graphics, what they gave you instead was lots of tangible stuff to hold in the real world. See pictured here, copy of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and it came with a whole bunch of feelies. You get a don't panic button, you get peril sensitive sunglasses, which are just cardboard flat black. You can see there's a little piece of fluff there under where it says fill out this and we'll fill you in. That is a little piece of fluff because there's a little piece of fluff in the game. So you get a little piece of fluff in real life. And there's also what looks to be an empty plastic bag, but it's actually a microscopic space fleet. And you get various flyers and things. And so all these tangible goods kind of got you in the mood for the game. The detective games were great for that. There's one called Witness, where you get sheets about the murder that you're investigating, but you also get invited to this place that the crime is going to take place. So you see your invitation, you get a book of matches, like that has clues on it, and like all those things. And then the feelies would often be used as copy protection as well. Like there'd be something in the game, you could only get so far, then you would require knowledge from one of these tangible things to proceed in the game.
It would be like there'd be like a map of space and just like, you know, enter the coordinates to get from, you know, Alpha Centauri to planet Z or whatever, and then you had to, you know, actually look at the map, and it made it more physical and fun, but also was an excellent form of copy protection. So feelies were the things you could hold, and browsies were things that you could read. With, of course, the manual and stuff, but also here in this Infocom thing, you could see the order of destruction for the houses. And sometimes, again, it was just fun stuff that would set the mood for the game. And sometimes, often, they provided information that you really needed to know in order to get past a certain puzzle or
And frequently in these what are called gray boxes, the one that's there, which is kind of the canonical box, we'll talk about earlier versions as well, but for a lot of the releases, this was the kind of format box that came in and opened up like a record album for those, again, young people don't know it's a thing that records came in. And attached to that would be like a magazine, basically. And that was the manual for the game, but would usually take the format of something else. Like if it was an adventure game, it might be issue 7 of some Adventurer's Weekly magazine. And so in that would be your instructions, but also be articles and things that would set the stage. So they were all about like that tangible feel that put you in the world. And then you would just sit down in front of plain text and it would hopefully carry you through. So those are the standard boxes, but there were also really fancy boxes, especially early on, things called folio editions and cool box art, and amazing stuff.
Right. There's one here pictured that was a mask of someone who was cryogenically frozen. There was one that looked like a UFO, like a spaceship, a circular UFO. And they were really cool, and they were probably expensive to produce. And the people who owned computer software stores. There used to be computer software stores. You could buy computer software. It was like an app store, but in real life. They hated them because they were impossible to like keep on the shelf. You know, people, if you're stocking shelves, you want square boxes. And these, you know, what are you going to do with a UFO-shaped thing that's going to roll off the shelf all day? So.
Yeah, they wouldn't fit on shelves and that sort of thing. But those become the really collectible ones nowadays. Again, these games are really accessible. You just want to play the text. But if you want to own them and have those physical things, there's lots of scans and stuff online. But some of the most fun packaging are the really early ones, not just because of the feeling browsy, but because of the really unique packaging that they came in. Then there were a thing called InvisiClues, which didn't come with the game, but were kind of separate items that you could purchase that would be a very unique way of helping you through the puzzles. And we'll get to puzzles shortly. And the InvisiClues format was interesting. And the idea was you could have in your hands solutions to a bunch of puzzles, but just glancing over it, you wouldn't get spoiled. So instead, you would use an invisible ink revealing pen, and you would just, like it shows here, kind of wipe out or reveal one line at a time to get just enough hint to help you through a puzzle. I love the format.
Yeah, it was very a fun, super fun format and a way to progress in the game when you're feeling frustrated. Sometimes, due to piracy, Infocom sold more InvisiClues books than they sold copies of the game.
And another thing that would come with InvisiClues is you can see in the background there is a copy of the Zork 1 map, or part of the map, actually. So you can see how intricate these game worlds are. A lot of times, they are essentially an open world. Sometimes you're limited to certain areas. Some games, it's small areas you leap around. Some games, you kind of unlock more and more areas you go. And some games are just, here you are, there's 80 rooms, things are scattered all over the place, you figure it out.
Right. Some are very, very linear. Yeah, very linear, and some are more of an open world. Figure it out. Yeah.
Exactly. And that brings us to the hard stuff. Mm-hmm. One of the big hard things is number two here. Number two, the mapping. These games don't map themselves. A lot of times it's what they call, I think the cliche was twisty passages all alike. So this kind of thing where you're in one room and you go east, then you go west, and you're not back where you started. Highly frustrating, and early Infocom games in particular are chock full of mazes like this, and I find them exceptionally frustrating and difficult to map. So does Kay, don't you, Kay?
I do. For a while, I just gave up on mazes. I mean, normally, you know, you go north, you go south, you're back to where you started, but then there's these mazes, and some of the mazes are just relentlessly terrible. And then, for a while, they got into different kinds of mazes that were fun. There would be like the 3D maze where it was, you know, you're in glass boxes and you can move in three, and you're like a flying bat or something. I don't remember. And that was interesting. Or there was a maze. I mean, one of the typical ways to get through a maze is, you know, say the maze has 10 rooms and you have 10 objects. Well, you can drop your knife in one room and then you go north and then you go east and you're like, you're in a room with a knife. Well, that's your knife. But what happens if you are a creature going through, if you're not a human and you can't hold things, then how do you solve a maze? So, you know, for a while, they were just punishing terrible mazes. And then they sometimes were more interesting, but mostly punishing.
Walkthroughs are a great way I have found to get through these mazes. And just tell you, type the following 18 commands and you'll get through it. Right. They, like Kay says, they can be absolutely maddening, some of these mazes. It just loops and, oh my goodness, just terrible. Another thing that could make the games very difficult are some of the mechanics of the game. Like, it's the fact that you're mapping yourself and you have to think very non-linearly a lot to solve the puzzles. To, like, you'll get an object and think, well, what is this thing? And sometimes things will be described, I think, intentionally to obscure what it is. So you'll be handed something, and if you saw it in real life, you'll know it's a horseshoe. But it will be described to you as a almost circular band of metal. That, like, what is this thing? And it can take ages to realize it's a horseshoe. I should put it on the horse.
Yeah, and then but the character is a cowboy and would know what a horseshoe is, so it's a little frustrating.
So there's lots of little games like that, and it breaks the fourth wall. There's lots of humor, but sometimes, like, the games are designed to be difficult. These were games designed for you to spend weeks or months playing, to group play, like you're playing it, your friends are playing it, and at 2 a.m. you wake up and you have an idea of something to try in the puzzle you're stuck on. You go back to the game and hopefully it works. And I had, over like a 4-year period, endless numbers of those moments. Like, at any given time over the last half a decade, Kay and I have been playing one of these games, and often I've just been stuck on a part of a game for weeks at a time, just beating my head on it until finally, out of the blue, you think of some way to combine some weird item, and then suddenly you're on to the next room and the next puzzle over and over
it's
again.
It's 2 a.m, you're falling asleep after a long day, and you're almost asleep, and then your brain is just like, oh, here's how you solve the problem, and then, of course, then you have to get up or wait until the next, you know, and then the shower and stuff. So, yeah, it was meant to be, you know, when these games cost, what, $40 and $1980, they were expensive, and people expected serious gameplay time out of it. So you could literally be playing while at work, you know, thinking about it. You know, how am I going to get the fish in my ear, or, you know, whatever. So, yeah.
That's an excellent example. The fish in the ear, Kay. That is one of the most famous puzzles, in fact, from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the book. Douglas Adams partnered with almost all of the imps, the implementers. It's what the Infocom people call themselves, the implementers. Buddied up with Douglas Adams to make a version of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And in the game version, of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy was one of the most notorious puzzles of all. I think we're going to walk people through, or you're going to walk people through, how to solve that incredibly difficult, famous puzzle, aren't you, Kay?
Yes, I am. So, okay, normally on the podcast, we have a spoiler fence and we don't spoil games. But here, I'm going to spoil how to do this puzzle on this game. I'm going to tell you right up how to do it. Look, this game came out 40 years ago and...
you've had your chance.
You've had your chance to play it. So, yeah, like Carrington said, this was one of the notoriously difficult games. One of the definitely one of the most famous puzzles in the canon. So, Arthur Dent has gotten off of his planet, which has exploded, and he finds himself awakened in the hold of a Vogon constructor ship, and the player as Arthur Dent has to retrieve a babelfish from a babelfish vending machine, and he's wearing a dressing gown, and his inventory includes a stack of junk mail and a towel, and also in the room is Ford Prefect, who is asleep, and he's got his Ford Prefect has his satchel filled with interesting things, but you're not allowed to open it because it's Ford's satchel. So there's Ford and his satchel, and there's the things that you're wearing. And so you want to get to this fish in your ear. So you press the button on the vending machine. The fish is vended, but with such force that it flies across the room and into a hole in the wall. It just zips across the room. Mm. So therein lies the puzzle, right?
What can you possibly do?
What can you do? So, but then you notice above the hole is a hook. So, you know, maybe you take your towel and you try to hang the towel on the hook. But it falls off.
To block the hole,
right.
That's good thinking.
Yeah, sure. But the towel falls off. It is not the right tool for that job. So eventually you can take off your dressing gown. So you are walking, you're now naked in the Vogon constructor ship.
Got pajamas.
Hold. Sure. And you hang the dressing gown from the hook. Great. This is going to solve our problem. You press the button, the vented babelfish flies through the air and hits the ground and drops to the floor into a previously unseen drain on the floor.
Because of course it does.
Now, I'm going through this fast, but remember, what we just did may have taken a week of your life, right, to figure out this. So, cover the drain with the towel. Great. Press the button again. The fish flies through the air and it hits the gown and it drops to the floor and it lands on the towel. And a cleaning robot flies into the room, cleans up the fish, and flies out again through a panel in the wall. So this is where a lot of people really, really got stuck, and it was 2 weeks later in your life, and then finally you're trying things, and you decide to block the panel with Ford.
Or purchase the Invisiclues.
Sure, yes. Purchase the Invisiclues. Block the panel with Ford Prefect's big satchel. Press the button. Fish flies to the air. Fish hits the ground, drops to the floor, lands on the towel, and the cleaning robot flies into the room, cleans up the fish, crashes into the satchel, and throws the fish into the air where the fish is cleaned away by another cleaning robot, which is tasked with cleaning junk in the top half of the room, the upper half of the room. And then another month of your life might pass before you decide that what you need to do is take your pile of junk mail and put it on top of the satchel and press the button. The fish flies through the air and it hits the gown and it drops to the floor and it lands on the towel and the cleaning robot flies into the room and cleans up the fish and crashes into the satchel and throws the fish and the pile of junk mail into the air and it's crashed. And the second robot for the task with cleaning the top half of the room comes in, sees all the junk, flies out to clean it, and is so occupied by grabbing the junk mail that it misses the fish where it lands in your ear. Puzzle solved.
Congratulations, Kay.
You've gotten 5 points out of a possible 100. And the other thing I need to say was this was, this puzzle was renowned at being one of the most difficult. It was not. This was a typical puzzle on a typically difficult game. And it was extraordinarily fair, which not all Infocom puzzles were. And I think it got that people thought it was particularly hard because this was Infocom's best-selling game, and it was played by a lot of noobs who had never played Infocom games before and just had never for a first timer, this is a hard puzzle. But for a hardened Infocom person, you know, not so much. And then so we go here, and like in the next room, you have to get through a puzzle where you are being read. I have to survive being read Vogon poetry, and it puts you straight into, after you survive that, you are put into outer space without a spacesuit on, and you have to figure out how to survive that. And then you're thrust into what I think is, I feel, is the main portion of the game. You haven't even started the game at this point. So that is...
And that's the thing is, when we played this game, I went in not having played it before, but having heard about this supposedly impossible Babelfish puzzle. And I remember thinking, nope, that's compared to a lot of puzzles we've solved. That was actually pretty straightforward. And like you say, remarkably fair. Sometimes it is far more difficult to solve these things. I mean, that's kind of what... made Infocom games famous is the difficulty of the puzzles. An interesting thing about this particular one, it became the difficulty of this puzzle became part of the marketing of the game as well. And it was the case that you could even get a t-shirt that would say, I got the Babelfish, to show your fellow new friends that you had solved that incredibly difficult puzzle, to give more money to Infocom, buy the InvisiClues, buy the t-shirt, live the lifestyle. That's what I say. Funny thing about Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, one of my favorite things about that game is it plays with the format. By the time they get to that game, halfway through the 80s, Infocom is aware of the tropes of their own games, and they're aware that their players are as well. So they start to play with those. There's an inventory in all these games where you hold stuff. Like in this case, Kay was saying how you can have a satchel, you can have mail, you can have a Babelfish eventually. In this game, Hitchhikers, your starting inventory has two things. You say, what's my inventory? You start with a splitting headache and no tea. That's your inventory. So it really starts to break the fourth wall and play with the games. And that kind of humor, like wordplay and such, if you're a fan of Douglas Adams, those things are not just in the two games that Douglas Adams contributed to for Infocom, but right across pretty much every single game they made. They're kind of famous for the humor and the wordplay, which is amazing, and I enjoyed for the entire 4 years or so we played these things. So lots of the games are great. Some are less great. I think now we're going to talk about ones we particularly recommend, correct?
Yes,
we are. Okay, tell me your favorites.
According to this keynote presentation that you made last night...
I say you like these.
That's right. No, these really are some of my favorites. A Mind Forever Voyaging, I think, is one of the best games, and also a good one for first timers, perhaps. It is a story in which you revisit the same town in like 10, 20, 30, 40, and 50 years in the future from the starting date, and see what happens given a particular government philosophy. See how well it plays out. Enchanter, the Enchanter series is actually three games. Maybe my very favorite of all, in which it's magic, and you can do spells. So in addition to having inventory items to solve puzzles, you have a book of spells, and you can learn spells and use those spells to solve problems and create problems. And Trinity, which is maybe one of the very, very best games, which is not easy, but it's all about nuclear war. There's another game I particularly like, which probably is most people would not pick, called Hollywood Hijinks, which is a treasure hunt sort of game where you are in a big mansion and you have to. It's a pure puzzle game where you would try to solve puzzles in a mansion in order to win a big prize that your aunt left you. What about you, Carrington? What do you like?
First of all, I like all of your choices. Those are all fantastic. I could easily have said, yeah, those were my choices. All three of those games are absolutely incredible. I'm going to recommend three others, kind of go a different way. And these are three other games that I just adored all the way through. First is the Lurking Horror. It is a horror game in text. It's creepy, it's chilling, it's set in MIT, has some difficult puzzles, had cool ending, really just spine tingly. It's lovely and gooey. And
I really didn't think I was going to like it, and ended up really loving that game.
It's great. It's the game I was most looking forward to the entire time we started it. Everyone else talks about Hitchhikers and Zork and all these other games and Planetfall. And I was like, I want to play the horror one, and it totally held up. I loved it. Another one I'd recommend is Plundered Hearts, where you play a lady kind of seeking agency among swashbucklers and cads. It has by far, I think, the best ending of any of the games, but it is an alternate ending. There are two kind of primary endings you can get, where you're basically forced to choose between your love and your family, but you can say, screw you both, I'm going a third direction, and it's the best ending of all of the games. I like that game a ton. And also Planetfall, which is funny and famous, one of the most famous games in Infocom. Tons of humor. It's a very, very funny game, but also some heart-wrenching stuff. Great non-player character that you interact with, and it's terrific for fans of hard science fiction. It's basically a post-apocalyptic setting. Future, you're in space and you land on a planet that's developed, but everyone's gone, and you have no idea where they've gone and why they left, and is the thing that made them leave still here and still dangerous? And that's what you're investigating, plus tons of humor. Amazing game. Absolutely loved it. For noobs, I would recommend Moonmist, game I adored. It's neat in that it's a shorter game, so you don't have to commit to 6 weeks or 2 months to play, and has three different endings. So you kind of pick which track you want to play. It's like the movie Clue. So it's a mystery game that has three potential murderers or criminals they have to catch. And so you can play it three times with different endings. It's a haunted house, castle kind of mystery, and I really, really liked it. So I would recommend that one. But Moonmist brings us to the idea of split decisions. I think it is the case that no Infocom game is universally loved or hated. They had a huge range of genres, and I liked Moonmist a lot. Kay, on the other hand, not so much.
Not so much. Nope. Wasn't for me. In fact, I only played through one of the three endings because I just didn't dig it. I typically don't love a mystery, and so
why is that?
I don't know.
It's a quandary.
I'm willing to be wrong. And many times these games, like I said,
Not just willing, but able.
Yeah. I didn't think I'd like Lurking Horror, but I ended up loving it. Moon, I typically don't like a mystery, but it didn't do enough to make me like it. So it just wasn't my thing. And so, yeah. Another one, another split decision was Border Zone, which was a kind of an 80s spy thriller. And it's a game that I actually played, It's like in some invented land in Eastern Europe, and there's spy stuff going on, and you actually play from three different perspectives. You're a spy on a guy on a train trying to sneak information, and then you're later the guy who's received the information trying to get it to the other spy dude, and so I thought it really played with the capabilities of what a text adventure is. And in one part of the game there, you are, they really kind of pull out the stops and like what you could do in a text adventure. You are trying to get past the border, and there are searchlights happening, and it actually like tells you in real time, the searchlight is going north, you know, northeast, east, southeast. And you have to like time your move in order to make it, you know, do things at a certain time. And that, you know, they were experimenting with the genre a lot, and sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't. So
I think that one didn't. I didn't like the time-based stuff, because one of the things I enjoy about a text adventure is it is not timed. It's not a Twitch game. It's the exact opposite of an arcade game. So when you're old and slow, you can still play these games, because you can be stuck on a puzzle and then just pause, walk away, make a tea. You have all the time you want. So the introduction in Border Zone of timed events, I was like, nope, Big stinker. I vote no. Didn't like it at all. Sherlock, on the other hand, was amazing. So listen to nothing Kay says about it. But I went into that game loving Sherlock Holmes. Love everything Holmesian. Read all the books. Love the short stories. Love the movies, the TV shows. I like every version of it. I'm a huge fan. So it gave me what I wanted. But Kay went in not knowing Sherlock Holmes stuff, and it kind of expects you to know Sherlock Holmes stuff. And I think it's just not a game for everybody. So I think we should stay on the screen for a while and just look at that Sherlock box, just so you can enjoy it again.
Click the next.
So remember how I said no Infocom game is universally hated? On our podcast, that might be not true, because there's some that I do not think hold up. Most of these games hold up, which is amazing for 35-year-old games. It's crazy that you can sit down and just enjoy these things as they are. Some, not so much. I think the champion of that would be Cutthroats. It is dude bro central, full of sexism and a plot with a goal that literally never resolves. It is uncomfortable. It's sometimes you watch like movies from the 1980s and they contain a lot of stuff where you think, wow, you shouldn't say that. That's this game. Really not something somebody should go and play. Didn't like it at all. I say no. Norton Burt, what do you think of that one?
Norton Burt was another very different kind of game. It says on the box, tales of cliches, spoonerisms, and other verbal trickery. It's puzzles too, but a very different kind. In fact, I think it's like 10 or 12 different types of little puzzles. I can't think of any of them. It's all puns and stuff, and
there's like no puzzle in it really. I kind of, but they're just, oh, that game didn't hold up at all, I thought, which is too bad.
Yeah,
the big shocker, I think, that even says gasp on the slide, my goodness, is Zork. The Zork games in general, I didn't really like them that much, and Zork 1 in particular, it's a punishing game. I think more famous for the fact that it's the first one than the fact that it's an amazing one. So it might be, like we said, the Kleenex of text adventures, like everybody knows it, but boy howdy, I think you got to be an Infocom completionist to want to tackle that one.
Right, and there are many Zork games, and some of them are good, and some of them are Zork.
They just don't hold up. Like, the reality is Infocom, the core part of Infocom, stayed around for about a decade, late 70s to late 80s. Eventually, for a variety of reasons, some people say Cornerstone, but just graphics became big. Eventually, and fairly quickly, it went from a huge company with massive hits to going out of business and sold to Activision. And then just the brand lived on and lives on, but no longer the same thing at all. And I think during that 10-year period, they explored a ton of ways to make games, ways to make puzzles, ways to expand the whole idea of interactive fiction, none of which existed in Zork because it was the first one. And it's just, boy howdy, it's just puzzles and punishment and lots of humor. Like, all the games are really funny. It is a very funny game, but it ain't, I would not recommend it to anybody who hasn't played a bunch of these already. You'll never get through it.
True. Yeah.
Yeah. So that is Infocom and the past, but we're now going to talk about the future with lots of U's. So that makes it exciting, I think. Text adventures and interactive fiction have changed. Like, modern IF, I think, differs a lot from these old Infocom games. There's a lot in common as well. I mean, it's still text. You're still typing. You're still solving puzzles and imagining everything in your mind. But I think modern IF learned a lot of lessons.
It's true. I mean, modern gamers have modern gaming sensibilities. And what we expect now is indeed very different. You're not... People, I mean, okay, I was going to say is people don't want to play a game for 40 hours, but some games people do want to play for 40 hours, but no one wants to be stuck at any part of a game for weeks. And there's no impetus for that anymore when your game costs $2.99 in an app store or was a free download or whatever. So puzzles have typically gotten less punishing. Game designers have learned how to do better.
There's a thing, a phrase that gets used with old Infocom games and old games in general, this idea of learning by death. That's a big part of Infocom games. There's many times, especially in the earlier games, there are things you cannot succeed at until you fail at them first. You'll walk in a room, you'll have no indication whatsoever that a thing you're about to do will end your game, but you have to do it first. And then the doing of that will unveil something else that lets you either get by that puzzle or past another puzzle. So the whole idea of learning by death is frowned upon nowadays, but was just a thing you had to put up with Infocom games.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And sometimes you just lack a piece of knowledge that would have help you solve the puzzle. There was one recently, and I simply didn't know that a certain thing was flammable. And I never, you know, it's just not something that I...
We had very different childhoods.
Another kind of puzzle that modern games don't have anymore, I hope, is walking deaths, where you have lost the game, but you don't know it yet. It's like, whatever, you need the banana to feed the monkey, you know, in the penultimate scene of the game, but you use the banana in the second scene to give to the, to eat yourself or to give to the baby otter or whatever it was. Baby otters love bananas.
They love bananas. That is a bit of knowledge I didn't know.
And basically, I mean, you have lost the game, but there's no way of knowing it. And then you've got to start over, or you're like wondering, like, should I, you know, so you've got to start over and replay the game again and then find out, oh, well, it wasn't the banana after all, the, you know, so games.
It's always the banana.
It's always the banana.
Another thing that has changed a lot in modern IF, it seems, is one of the mechanics that kind of nobody liked from earlier games was what we list here as limited time, food, and sleep. So you'll have like a light source that can only be shining for 20 moves. And you don't know, like, do you need to fully min-max optimize this to make every one of those moves count? Or do you actually only need it for 3 moves and you're fine and you have no idea? Will it enter you into a walking death seat? Like, will you need it later on? Constantly, I would have stress over the fact, like, should I eat this thing? Should I sleep now? If I sleep here, will I die? But if I sleep, will I miss out on something else? Like, and you just never know. Like, often when you play these games, there's something in the back of your head saying, am I stuck on this puzzle because I'm stuck on this puzzle? Or am I stuck on this puzzle because I screwed up something 6 weeks ago and I'm going to kick myself? And you don't know. So that's something that really, I find when I play modern IF, you don't get those, oh, you only get this for 4 uses and you have no idea whether that's enough for you or what have you. So that is another, I think, good change from the Infocom days. So I like that. There's some improvements.
Yeah. And some games today don't have any parsers at all. They like a lot of games made with Twine, they're just click games. You know, you sit, it gives you a couple choices, you click them or what phrase do you want to say, and so you don't have to type at all. Different kind of, it's still interactive fiction. It's still a text adventure. It's just no parser. It's just different, done differently.
That is a thing that we talked about earlier, and that Infocom really pushed, this idea that it's not just a text adventure. They rarely wanted to call themselves text adventures. They call themselves interactive fiction. And the reality is a good handful of their games have nice long plots and stories that go all the way through them. But most of them, plot at the beginning, long string of puzzles, plot at the end. So how much of it's interactive fiction when it comes to Infocom games, I'm not sure. Modern IF is often truly interactive fiction. Explores with the whole idea. And like, so if you're interested in something that's less just full on puzzle, 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 you might find more in modern interactive or modern text adventures than in the Infocom games. Although A Mind Forever Voyaging has basically no puzzles, all plot, totally amazing. So that's the kind of game you want. You might want to seek out that one versus something like a Zork game. I think that brings us to the end of the info we wanted to push upon everybody. And we wanted to leave a few minutes at the end in case people had particular questions about anything we've mentioned or Infocom games in general or text adventures in general. Anybody have something they want to throw at us?
Yeah, and I have queued up one that I saw go by. If you have a question, ask it now in the chat. And while you're doing that, I'm going to answer one that I happened to notice while Carrington was talking. Beth asked, is there a legal way to acquire Infocom games that does not involve purchasing a floppy drive? So Bethel wants to be legal, doesn't want to be a dirty pirate, doesn't believe in abandonware, and fine, I appreciate that. So Infocom stuff is owned by Activision now, and Activision seems to have no interest in Infocom anymore right now. They've got bigger fish to fry. And up to a few years ago, you could buy Infocom games on your iPad or iPhone or Android or whatever. There was a neat little thing. You paid $9.99 and you had all the Infocom games on your phone. They don't offer that anymore. They stopped updating it at some point. So as far as I know, there's no legal official way to buy Infocom games. Now, it doesn't mean you can't get them. They are all online. You can download the Zoom interpreter or many other interpreters. You can download the Z files, the ZIL files. You can play them. But Beth wants to be at least have some amount of legalness, in which case I would go to eBay. And many of the games were released on CD-ROM compilations. There'd be like the Best of Infocom Volume 1, 2, and 3, or the Mystery Adventures or whatever. And you can buy the CD-ROM, and it would come with a lot of a printout of a book of the Browsies and Feelies and things. And it certainly wasn't the same experience as buying the games back in the day, but it is legal. And even if you don't have a CD-ROM drive today, you can buy the game, you can own cheaply and easily 30 or all of the games, and then you can legitimately download them from the internet, or just copy the Z files from the CD-ROM to your computer and play them in the Zoom interpreter or whatever you like. A few of the games were never released on CD-ROM because the licenses ran out. For instance, Shogun and Sherlock, I think. But most of them are, you can get legitimately and legally that way.
My favorite way to play, because I like old computers, surprise, was a thing called Pitch Dark, which a person named 4AM and another person named Cucumber put together, and it is a collection of all the games for an Apple II. Now, you can run it on an Apple II emulator. You can download Pitch Dark from Internet Archive and an Apple II emulator from all over the place. And if you combine the two, or you put Pitch Dark on an actual vintage Apple II, then you get all of the games all bundled together on a ready-to-play hard drive that gives you save slots for all of them, all the various versions of all the games, and even high-res screenshots of the front of the boxes. It's a delightful way to play them, and I played a ton of the games using that.
Yes. Also, the source code to all these games is available on GitHub. That's fun, too. Other questions? How would Feelies work out now, and how would you add them to modern IF? Carrington, you have 2 minutes before our time slot's done.
Feelies, I think, they're just like a physical thing. Most of the time nowadays, if you go and play IF, the Feelies come as digital versions. It's just PDFs of things. It's printouts or audio files or movies or that sort of thing. So the Feelies have just gone digital. Part of the fun of old Infocom games is those packaged things, but they can be expensive on eBay if you just want to pick it up and play a game once. So I mostly recommend people just play them and just look at pictures of the Feelies, and honestly, it's 90% as good.
Same person asked, what engine do you recommend for building IF today? Say you want to do your own, I would say Inform or Twine. Check those out, see which one you like.
I say Puny Inform. It's a subset of Inform designed specifically to target 8-bit computers. Run on modern computers, but you can also run it on like an Atari 8-bit or an Apple II if you wanted to.
Great. Our time is up, and I do not want to run over, and I thank you all for coming and for being interested in Infocom. You can find us. Our podcast is Eaten by a Gru, available in your favorite podcast listening app. On Twitter, I am at KSavitz. He is at Carrington. And thank you for coming.
Yeah, cheers, everyone. I really appreciate you listening to us. Have a good cruise.
Walked into the slavering fangs of a lurking Gru.
It makes a big difference, though. Like, hearing other people laugh will make me think a thing is funnier. Mm-hmm. It's a weird psychology. That's why I have people walk around with me and just, like, laugh all the time.
sycophants laughing at you. Oh, yes, Carrington. Ha, 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 ha. Oh, how droll.